A Boeing FedEx cargo jet skids on its nose while landing. The front landing gear failed as the jet came in at a Turkish airport. How the pilot saved the day.
In D.C., police cleared the protest encampment at George Washington University that was just hours before the mayor and police chief were set to testify at a House hearing. Our Washington correspondent, Luis Martinez, standing by.
An overview of how Trump and Biden are faring in a head-to-head 2024 matchup, plus how the religious vote is changing.
The Biden administration reportedly blocking an arms shipment to Israel. We have more about the reason why and how Israel responds.
Russia says it would attack French troops if they're being sent to Ukraine. Details on the warning from Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman.
A pro-democracy song is now banned in Hong Kong at Beijing's request. What it means for free speech and for Google.
This is NTD News Today, live from our NTD global headquarters. Here are Stephania Cox and Chris Beers.
Another incident involving a Boeing-made aircraft. A FedEx Airlines cargo plane landed at Istanbul Airport by skidding on its nose.
The plane was unable to deploy front landing gear that controls the front wheel.
Turkey's transport ministry said the plane managed to stay on the runway and avoided casualties.
The nearly 10-year-old Boeing 767 aircraft was flying from Paris Charles de Gaulle Airport. Pilots informed the traffic control tower at Istanbul Airport that its landing gear failed to open and it landed with guidance from the tower.
The pilots held the plane's nose above the runway for several seconds after the main wheels had touched ground. According to the Skybrary Aviation Database, it's an emergency landing maneuver that pilots train for.
Airport rescue and firefighting teams made necessary preparations on the runway before landing. After landing, the plane was doused with firefighting foam. The Department of Justice is nearing a decision on whether Boeing broke a 2021 deal to avoid prosecution over two fatal 737 MAX crashes. Families of crash victims received a letter inviting them to a May 31st meeting to learn the decision, as reported by ABC, that is. If Boeing violated the agreement, it could face historic criminal charges impacting the aviation industry. Families have criticized what they see as the DOJ's lack of transparency, but are eager to hear the decision. This meeting marks the fourth session between the DOJ family and families who have been pushing for accountability since the crashes.
We have some breaking news. Georgia's appeals court has agreed to hear former President Trump's bid to disqualify Fulton County DA Fani Willis. Fulton County Judge Scott McAfee previously allowed Willis to continue prosecuting Trump after special prosecutor Nathan Wade resigned.
Trump and eight of his co-defendants in the Georgia RICO case have urged the appeals court to overturn McAfee's ruling.
Trump's lawyer said Trump looks forward to arguing why the case should be dismissed and why DA Willis should be disqualified.
The court's decision to hear the appeal before trial could cause further delays in the case. The losing side could still appeal the appeal court's decision to the Georgia Supreme Court.
And today, President Biden is making a campaign stop in the battleground state of Wisconsin. He's planning specifically to speak with black voters.
In 2020, Biden carried the state by just 21,000 votes, thanks to turnout in Madison and the suburbs. The turnout in Milwaukee's majority black precincts was lower.
This is Biden's fourth trip to Wisconsin this year. While there, the president is also expected to announce a new artificial intelligence facility in Racine. Microsoft is investing $3.3 billion in that project.
President Biden is going on the offensive with new ads targeting former President Trump on health care. Here's a clip of one of the ads.
Health care should be a basic right, folks. He's coming for your health care, and we're not going to let it happen.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
Biden's reelection campaign is spending of $14 million on ads in battleground states. That includes money for targeting minority groups.
The ads highlight Trump's attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Biden's campaign sees health care as a key issue, especially as the Affordable Care Act has gained popularity.
The Biden campaign is also focusing on what they see as Biden's achievements in health care, like capping insulin prices. And a House panel is accusing the Biden administration of using taxpayer money to help President Biden win a key battleground state. The House Committee on Small Business sent subpoenas to two administration officials yesterday. The committee is investigating the Small Business Administration, or SBA, and a first-of-its-kind voter registration agreement in Michigan.
The GOP-led House panel says the deal with Michigan's Department of State could favor Democrats over Republicans. The deal made in March has Michigan officials collaborate with the SBA to drive online visitors to register to vote. It also lets Michigan officials use the SBA's Michigan field office for in-person voter registration.
The SBA is also encouraging voter registration nationwide. Independent candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is challenging former President Trump to a debate. The venue, the Libertarian National Convention in Washington, D.C. Both Kennedy and Trump are scheduled to speak at the event, hosted from May 23rd to May 25th.
In an open letter on X, Kennedy said Trump supporters are now supporting him. He added that the Libertarian Convention is the perfect neutral territory for a debate.
Kennedy mentioned CNN and Quinnipiac surveys indicating he stood above the 15% mark. That's the minimum needed for a presence on stage in the presidential debates.
Trump's campaign did not respond to Kennedy's post.
And looking at results from Indiana's primaries, Senator Mike Braun wins the Republican nomination in the governor's race. Democratic nominee Jennifer McCormick was unopposed.
Braun chose to run for the open governor's seat instead of a second term in the Senate. He beat five GOP contenders looking to replace Republican Governor Eric Holcomb.
Congresswoman Victoria Spartz will run to serve another term after defeating several GOP challengers. NTD's Jeremy Sandberg has more Indiana primary results.
We have the false choice.
Indiana Representative Victoria Spartz is projected to win the GOP primary for her 5th district seat. The Ukrainian-born congresswoman first won the seat in 2020. Spartz faced eight challengers Tuesday night after deciding to seek re-election. Competition included State Representative Chuck Goodrich, a businessman who outspent Spartz. Spartz was an early advocate for U.S. support for Ukraine, but she voted against the $95 billion foreign aid package with $61 billion for Ukraine last month. Goodrich aired television ads accusing Spartz of putting Ukraine first. Democratic nominee Deborah Pickett will challenge Spartz for her seat. Meanwhile, in the race for Indiana's next governor, Senator Mike Braun bested five GOP competitors to win the Republican primary, including incumbent Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. Braun is seeking to replace term-limited Republican Governor Eric Holcomb. Indiana has had a Republican governor since 2004. Braun will face Democratic nominee Jennifer McCormick in the November general election. McCormick, a former Republican, changed parties in 2021. Libertarian nominee Donald Rainwater and independent Christopher Street have also thrown their hats in the ring. Jeremy Sandberg, NTD News.
More on the presidential election. We'll get an overview of how the presumptive nominees Biden and Trump are faring in a head-to-head matchup.
Yes, and we'll look at the religious vote and how voter sentiment there is changing. The Pew Research Center says 20% of American adults identify as Catholic. That's about 52 million people. So this group could prove to be one decisive factor in November. NTD's Kevin Hogan joins us now to break down the numbers at the Data Hub. What can you tell us there, Kevin?
Yes, Steph and Chris, out here in the Data Hub, we're going to look at who Americans would vote for were the 2024 presidential election held today. Right here, we see President Biden picking up 48% of the vote, and that's compared to former President Donald Trump's 49%. This just shows that these two candidates are neck and neck, virtually, according to Pew Research Center poll. And this is assuming that RFK Jr., a third party candidate, is not in the race, and he could pick up about 10% of the vote there. And now just keep in mind that this neck and neck, 48% to 49%, is only a snapshot of this race, given that it's the Electoral College that is going to ultimately determine the outcome of this election. Right now, we're going to look at the religious vote. So who would Catholics vote for? Right now, as it stands, according to Pew, 43% of Catholics would pick President Biden, whereas 55% would pick former President Donald Trump. The significance of those numbers falls in the fact that back in 2020, 49% of Americans chose President Biden as their pick, whereas 50% only chose former President Trump. So that is a 6-point drop-off that we're seeing here for the Catholic vote for President Biden, whereas Trump is picking up about 5%. Some analysts say that this is driven largely by the Hispanic Catholics that are now shifting from the Democrat Party, a party that they have done a lot to retain this group, now over to the Republican Party. Let's move on here. we look at the Protestant vote in the 2024 presidential election. Not much has changed from now to 2020. For President Biden, 38% to 40%. It's about a wash, 2 points, not much. And for former President Trump, 60% now compared to 59% back in 2020. This is just very similar that we're seeing here. However, former President Trump is picking up about 22 points more than President Biden here in the Protestant vote. And that could be largely driven by the fact that former President Trump espouses a lot of these conservative values, whereas President Biden has championed these more progressive values and policies in his time in office here. Now, we're going to look at the black Protestant vote here. Now, according to Pew, 77% of black Protestants choose President Biden, whereas 18% would pick former President Trump. 18% seems like a small number, but when we look back to the 2020 vote, we can see that President Trump's support among black Protestants has doubled in those 4 years, whereas President Biden's support has dwindled by about 14 points in this particular voting group. Now, we're going to look at a recap here, and we're going to see how President Biden is losing support among religious groups, 6 points here from the Catholics and 2 points from the Protestants across the board, whereas former President Trump, he is picking up support, 5 points here from the Catholic vote, 1 point here from the Protestant vote. So he is gaining across the board in terms of the total religious vote. And this is very important considering that Protestants make up the biggest religious voting group in America and Catholics come right behind at second. Thank you so much. Back to you, Steph and Chris.
New Yorkers won't be voting on abortion access this November. A judge found that state lawmakers didn't follow procedural rules surrounding passing constitutional amendments.
Democrats passed the Equal Protection of Law amendment last year. It would address discrimination based on, quote, pregnancy outcomes or gender expression. Its provisions are intended to indirectly protect access to abortion and cross-sex drugs and procedures.
The judge said the lawmakers incorrectly approved the amendment. They were supposed to first get a written opinion on the language from the state attorney general. AG Letitia James's office said it would appeal the decision.
The ruling is a setback for some Democrats who are hoping to spur voter turnout around abortion access.
House Republicans are introducing a bill that would ensure illegal immigrants don't vote in federal elections. The bill is being brought by Congressman Chip Roy with the support of House Speaker Mike Johnson.
The bill is being dubbed the SAVE Act. Non-citizen voting in federal elections is already prohibited, but past Supreme Court decisions limit states' power to make sure voters are actually citizens.
The SAVE Act would strengthen safeguards around voter registration to ensure compliance with existing laws. It would require applicants to show proof of citizenship when registering to vote.
The bill also provides accommodations for mail-in voting registration and for those who don't have documents to prove citizenship. They can undergo a separate process to have their citizenship verified.
The SAVE Act would also require Homeland Security to investigate non-citizens who are illegally registered to vote. Republican Senator Mike Lee is scheduled to introduce the same bill to the Democrat-controlled upper chamber.
Georgia is taking its own measures when it comes to ensuring that only eligible voters are voting. Governor Brian Kemp has signed a bill to change the state's election laws. One of the changes includes outlining the reasons for removing voters from the rolls. It lists death, voting or registering in another jurisdiction, and other possible probable causes.
Opponents say the bill Kemp signed yesterday would enable baseless removing voters, while supporters say it better protects against just that.
The measure also says homeless people must use the county voter registration office as their address. Opponents say that could make it harder for homeless citizens to cast ballots in their registered polling place, might be far away. And federal judges are telling Louisiana state lawmakers to draw up a new congressional election map by June 3rd, or they'll make one themselves. The Tuesday order comes after the judges rejected Louisiana's election map, which added a second mostly black district. Whatever comes out of the court could impact the makeup of the next Congress. A new mostly black district could give the Democrats the chance to capture another House seat, given the prevailing voting patterns in Louisiana. Louisiana Attorney General Liz Murrell says the ruling threatens the ability of the Secretary of State to conduct a stable and fair election. The latest development comes after the court on April 30th rejected a map that converted District 6 into a mostly black district. The judges said that the newest map violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment because race was the predominant factor driving its creation. Coming up, an American woman who returned from Syria is facing charges of training with the ISIS terrorist group. We let you know what we know about her case.
And powerful tornadoes and storms caused damage in the Midwest. See dramatic footage from on the ground.
And the man who tried to shoot a pastor doing a service at a Pennsylvania church is charged with homicide. That's after a body was discovered in the assailant's home. More in just a moment here on NTD News Today. An American woman who was sent back to the U.S. from Syria is facing charges for allegedly training with ISIS abroad. Halima Salman is accused of learning how to use an AK-47 assault rifle with the ISIS terrorist group while she was living in Syria. She was one of 11 U.S. citizens, all part of the same family from northeast Syria who were repatriated.
According to court documents, Salman left the U.S. at 17 years old and entered the ISIS-controlled area in late 2016 or early 2017. Prosecutors said once Salman turned 18 years old, she received training from ISIS.
The FBI interviewed Salman last year. She allegedly told agents she had married an ISIS fighter, but denied being involved in any ISIS activities.
We now turn to updates on the Israel-Hamas war. The U.S. has reportedly paused an arms shipment to Israel amid concerns over the Rafah operation.
A Biden administration official told Reuters that the U.S. held up a shipment of over 3,000 bombs to Israel last week. This is reportedly over concerns that they may be used in the Rafah operation, which the U.S. opposes.
The official said the 2,000-pound bombs could have an impact in dense urban settings. The Israeli military appeared to respond, saying, quote, "When there are disputes, and there are, they are being resolved behind closed doors in a matter-of-fact way."
This comes as CIA Director Bill Burns met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to discuss ceasefire and hostage negotiations.
Inside Gaza, the UN says roughly 50,000 people have evacuated from Rafah, and the Kerem Shalom border crossing between southern Gaza and Israel has reopened to allow humanitarian aid.
The Biden administration is working on a report for Congress this week on whether Israel has violated international law during the war in Gaza. It could lead to significant repercussions and further inflame divisions at home and abroad.
The report has been the subject of intense debate for months within the administration, and it's already led to deep divisions inside the State Department.
The report will also weigh in on whether Israel has impeded the delivery of U.S. humanitarian assistance. And D.C. Metropolitan Police cleared an encampment of protesters at George Washington University hours before the city's mayor and chief of police were set to testify before the House Oversight Committee.
Our Washington correspondent Luis Martinez joins us now from the Capitol. Luis, what can you tell us about the situation there?
Yes, of course. So today, around 3:30 in the morning, Metropolitan Police cleared an illegal encampment of pro-Palestinian protesters that had been occupying parts of the George Washington University's campus since April 25th. Now, it's important that Pamela Smith, the Metropolitan Police Chief, stated that it was elements that they detected since last Thursday that prompted them to take action. Let's listen to what Pamela Smith, the Metropolitan Police Chief, had to say.
But over the past few days, we began to see an escalation in the volatility of the protests at GW. This started last Thursday when a GW campus police officer was pushed by protesters and an item was grabbed out of the police officer's hand during the performance of her duties.
The timeline is important because we need to remember that last week, George Washington University president sent a letter to D.C. officials requesting assistance from the police to clear the illegal encampment. D.C. police and D.C. mayor refused to assist George Washington University. And then last Wednesday, the House Oversight Committee went to the illegal encampment and announced a hearing summoning D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and Metropolitan Police Chief Pamela Smith to testify on their handling of these protests. And it was the day after that that they started detecting, according to the police chief, intelligence gatherings, elements that prompted it to take action. Let's listen to more of those elements that Metropolitan Police Chief signaled that they detected since last Thursday.
On Monday, MPD learned of more indicators that the protest was becoming more volatile and less stable. This included a simple assault reported to GW police, security probing of a GW building, indicators that counter demonstrators were covertly in the encampment, and information that protesters from other schools were traveling to GW. In addition, items that could potentially be used for offensive and defensive weapons were being gathered.
So at least 33 people were arrested, 29 of them for trespassing, 4 of them for assaulting police officer. Pepper spray had to be used in 3 different occasions, but the encampment has been cleared. It remains to be seen if George Washington University officials will permit students or other people who had taken part in these protests to protest elsewhere.
So, Luis, the Metropolitan Police and D.C. Mayor decided to act just 10 hours before they had to appear before the House Oversight Committee. Did the hearing play any part in the authorities' decision-making, do you think?
Of course, during this morning's press conference with the Metropolitan Police Chief and the D.C. Mayor, pressed, ironically, the officials on whether or not the timeline of the hearing had anything to do with the logic of taking action and clearing the encampment. And this is what both the Metropolitan Police Chief and Muriel Bowser, D.C. Mayor, had to say. Let's listen.
It did not. All the decisions that I've made is based on public safety. I had the opportunity to speak with Chairman Comer this morning, and he expressed his interest in making sure the city and the chief could focus on this ongoing operation. I expect that hearing will be pulled down.
So DC officials rejected the notion that the hearing had anything to do with their decision to take action and clear the encampment. House Oversight Committee Chairman Congressman James Comer said in a statement that he was pleased that the actions of the committee had forced DC officials to take action, but also confirmed that the hearing had been canceled, not postponed, but canceled. According to what DC Mayor Muriel Bowser said, Congressman James Comer and the House Oversight Committee wanted DC officials to focus on the ongoing situation. Back to you, Chris, Steph.
Luis Martinez on Capitol Hill, thank you. The man who tried to shoot a pastor during a service at a Pennsylvania church has been charged with one criminal count of homicide. A body was discovered in his home.
A short time ago, homicide detectives from a homicide unit filed a criminal complaint against Bernard Polite, age 26 of North Braddock, charging him with one count of criminal homicide. This is in the shooting death of his cousin, Derek Polite, in the incident that occurred on the morning of Sunday, May 5th.
The attempted shooting at the Jesus Dwelling Place Church in North Braddock took place Sunday while the service was being live streamed.
Bernard Polite entered the church just after 1 p.m. and walked toward the front while Reverend Glenn Germany was giving a sermon.
A deacon was able to thwart Polite's attack after the gun failed to fire.
Police say that gun was the same firearm used in the homicide. And more updates on severe weather conditions in the Midwest. A barrage of storms swept through the region yesterday, unleashing heavy rain, strong gusts of wind, and tornadoes.
Local media reported that multiple tornadoes touched down in southern Michigan throughout the day, causing damage to several buildings. Over a dozen residents were injured.
According to PowerOutage.us, more than 30,000 homes and businesses in Michigan were left without power as of this morning.
Residents across the Great Lakes and the Ohio Valley also saw large hail, damaging wind gusts, and heavy rainfall. A large area of the eastern and central U.S. will still face more rounds of storms today.
According to the Storm Prediction Center, nearly 4 million people are under a level 4 risk of severe thunderstorms. They cover parts of Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
And the last missing body of a construction worker killed in the Baltimore Bridge collapse has been recovered. Salvage divers found the body of Jose Minor Lopez yesterday at the scene of the bridge collapse.
The recovery comes more than a month after a cargo ship crashed into the bridge. The collapse that followed sent 8 construction workers into the Patapsco River, killing 6 of them.
All victims were Latino immigrants working an overnight shift, filling potholes on the bridge.
Police were able to stop traffic moments before the collapse, but they didn't have enough time to alert the workers.
And the container ship that crashed into the bridge in Baltimore is still stuck under part of the bridge structure. Now crews are preparing to use explosives to free it.
The crew of the Dolly is still on board the ship and will remain there even while the explosives are detonated. Maryland Governor Wes Moore said this complies with the best historical practices.
Moore said that once the Francis Scott Key Bridge's steel structure is safely removed from the water, the ship will float again. The channel would also be able to reopen. And a dump truck hit an overpass in Fairfax County, Virginia on Monday, and the shocking moment was caught on video. Take a look at the truck traveling in the left-hand lane on Interstate 66 with its trailer upright. It then strikes an overhead ramp support beam.
The trailer broke off and landed in a travel lane. Luckily, no other vehicles were damaged and no one was injured. It's unclear whether the dump truck driver realized the trailer was upright.
The driver who recorded the video called it a terrifying moment.
The accident caused lane closures on I-66 and snarled the evening commute for hours. Oregon's Portland Police Bureau is investigating a claim of responsibility for the arson of more than a dozen police vehicles last week.
The claim came in a social media post Monday by a group calling itself Rachel Carey's Ghost Brigade. 23-year-old Rachel Carey was killed in 2003 when an Israeli bulldozer crushed her while she was attempting to block it from demolishing Palestinian homes in Gaza.
The post read in part, "On May Day, we torched some PPB Portland Police Bureau cars at their training facility."
The self-proclaimed anarchist group referred to the pro-Palestinian demonstrations at colleges across the nation, specifically at Portland State University.
They described the arson as a preemptive attack against police in anticipation of operations against demonstrators at Portland State.
Lawmakers want to ensure quick refunds for airline passengers whose flights are canceled. House and Senate negotiators agreed to revise language in an aviation budget.
The changes mean refunds would be automatic in many instances unless passengers accept a new flight.
Senator Maria Cantwell said passengers can reject vouchers or alternative flights and without hassle get a refund if the changes pass.
The rule wouldn't offer compensation for delays. And the Internal Revenue Service says the deadline to claim the more than $1 billion in tax refunds from 2020 is about to expire. May 17th is the deadline for people who failed to file their 2020 tax return to become eligible for a refund. The IRS says there's no penalty for failure to file if a refund is due. However, a return claiming a refund must be filed within 3 years of its due date for a refund to be allowed. Traditionally, the filing deadline to claim old refunds are around April 15th, but in 2020, the filing deadline was extended to May 17th due to COVID-19. A state-by-state income tax breakdown sheet for 2020 is posted on the IRS website.
Up ahead, Secretary of State Antony Blinken discussing immigration with representatives from 22 different countries. What they said, including about allowing more people to enter countries legally.
Australia rejects Beijing's claim that Canberra is to blame for a dangerous military aircraft encounter between the two countries. Hear the Prime Minister's response after the break here on NTD News Today.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken discussing migration with representatives from 22 countries. Blinken joined them at a conference in Guatemala yesterday.
We stepped up efforts against those preying on vulnerable migrants. February, we announced a new visa restriction policy that targets individuals who knowingly provide transportation to those intending to migrate irregularly to the United States.
The conference had three main goals: to continue offering legal pathways to enter their countries, to provide aid to communities most affected by migration, and to coordinate their response to migration flows.
Blinken says progress has been made in all those areas, but he noted that people still migrate illegally, for example, through the Darien Gap and across the U.S.-Mexico border. Blinken says migrants should use legal pathways instead.
And now we have some short headlines from Russia, Scotland, and other European countries. Ukraine says Russia attacked its capital, Kyiv, overnight. Ukraine's emergency service reporting at least 2 people injured and 13 residential buildings damaged.
President Volodymyr Zelensky says a total of 7 Ukrainian regions have been attacked overnight, with Russia launching more than 50 missiles and 20 drones. The Ukrainian Air Force reportedly downed most of those.
Russia today said it would attack French troops if they're sent to Ukraine. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman sent the warning to French President Emmanuel Macron.
She also said Russia was seeing growing numbers of French nationals killed in the Ukraine war. She suggested some did not just fight in the war, but also led units of Ukraine's armed forces.
She added that if French citizens appear in the conflict zone, they will become targets. Romania's president says he's open to talking about sending a Patriot missile system to Ukraine. He made the remarks after meeting President Biden at the White House yesterday.
In 2017, Romania signed a $4 billion deal to receive Patriots. At the time, it was the biggest contract for any NATO or EU state. The first shipment was delivered in 2020.
The White House thanked Romania for its commitment to security in NATO's east. It also applauded Romania's defense investments, which exceed NATO's spending target. Scotland has a new first minister. John Swinney of the Scottish National Party has been sworn in today.
Swinney emerged as the sole contender for the role after the previous premier resigned.
The new first minister was the leader of the Scottish National Party from 2000 to 2004. He also served as Scotland's deputy first minister and finance minister. And North Macedonia, a small Balkan country, is holding parliamentary and presidential elections today. The conservative opposition is expected to gain ground against the ruling party.
No polls were published, but the opposition's strong showing in the first round of the presidential election suggests dissatisfaction.
Voters are frustrated over the slow progress toward EU accession and widespread corruption. A pro-democracy song is now banned in Hong Kong. A court greenlighted Beijing's request today. A lower court had rejected the ban, saying it could undermine free speech in Hong Kong.
The song Glory to Hong Kong was written in 2019 amid mass democracy protests. Many protesters consider it the unofficial national anthem, and Google even displays it when users search for Hong Kong's national anthem.
Google previously said it wouldn't change the search results to display China's national anthem, but now it says it's reviewing the court's judgment.
The ruling also has implications for anyone who spreads the song or suggests that Hong Kong is an independent state.
The song was already banned in Hong Kong schools as part of China's national security law in 2020 that gave Beijing greater power to tighten the control of the region.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese pushing back against China today. That's after Beijing blamed Australia for a dangerous clash between troops in international airspace.
The explanation given overnight by Chinese authorities does not satisfy any change to the position that we've taken.
A Chinese warplane used flares against an Australian Navy helicopter in international airspace over the Yellow Sea on Saturday. The Yellow Sea lies between China and the Korean Peninsula.
Flares can damage a helicopter's rotor blades or engines, leading to the downing of the aircraft. The clash is the most serious encounter between the two nations' militaries since last November.
Albanese stated that the Australian troops were carrying out missions to enforce UN sanctions against North Korea. Beijing said the helicopter flew deliberately close to China's airspace in a provocative move.
Albanese rejected that argument and called China's response unprofessional and unacceptable. Albanese added he will raise the disagreement with China's premier when he visits Australia next month.
Coming up, an elite French counterterrorism unit prepares for the Summer Olympics in Paris. They're training for worst-case scenarios amid geopolitical instability.
And NTD wins an award for best screenplay at the 15th annual LA Webfest in Hollywood. NTD's Ruby Lovell was at the event.
Paris has been on high alert since the 2015 terror attacks that killed 130 people and injured hundreds more. Now the 2024 Olympics, and particularly the opening ceremony, represent a significant security challenge for the French capital. NTD's Andrew Thomas has the latest.
An elite French counterterrorism unit breached this abandoned office building on the outskirts of Paris. The training exercise was held last month in preparation for a worst-case scenario at the Summer Olympics.
The Olympic Games are already the biggest media event in the world, and it only happens once every 4 years. There is a particular geopolitical context that I don't need to mention, and it is the biggest event, and it is the first time where thousands of GIGN soldiers will be mobilized without there being any rest.
Founded 50 years ago after the 1972 Munich Olympics massacre, the GIGN is one of France's elite tactical units. It's responsible for freeing hostages, counterterrorism operations, and other high-risk raids.
This type of exercise for us, what we want to work on, are attacks in environments that are big, with a significant number of people involved, hostages, even terrorists. So for us, the very important point of the mission is to practice on an attack that is swift and forceful, to neutralize the terrorists as quickly as possible, and above all, to preserve as many lives as possible.
The unit hopes fans can celebrate the games without incident.
I wanted to tell them that it's going to be a great event, that you shouldn't be afraid to come to France, that while zero risk obviously doesn't exist, and it would be dishonest to say that there is no risk, it is minimized as much as possible. So we will have a great games, it will be a great event.
The GIGN will assign 350 officers to the opening ceremony, with two plainclothes officers on each of the barges carrying athletes. Sharpshooters will be installed on the roofs of the buildings that line the Seine, with forces deployed below on the city streets. In all, around 50,000 French police and soldiers will secure Paris during the games. Andrew Thomas, NTD News.
An NTD original series just took home a prize at the 15th annual LA Web Fest. The TV drama series Dream of the Zelkova Tree won the award for Best Screenplay over the weekend. NTD's Ruby Lovell was at the festival. Let's take a look.
I'm at the 15th annual LA Web Fest Festival that focuses and showcases amazing, explosive new talent in the web series format. There are various categories for best short film, TV series, web series, pilots, podcasts, they're all recognized. This festival has the best of international talent. Started in 2009 as the first ever festival, this has now grown to one of the biggest film festivals, celebrating and supporting and nurturing new talent.
This is like a new media, a new wave style of a film festival. We are discover talent, like creator, also actress, producer, independent, right, filmmakers. And then, we're going to celebrate many things. And then we're going to give out a lot of awards tonight, about 40 categories.
So I'm here with Wendy and her daughter, Alexa. Congratulations, you're nominated for Best Actress for Luna the Witch.
It's a web series. We have 3 seasons so far. It's like a family-friendly sci-fi fantasy about, I play a witch who's not very good at being a witch, and she accidentally blows up the boy that she liked.
James Pax, how are you?
Thank you, I'm flattered. Yes, very well, very well.
You have had a very accomplished career. Big Trouble in Little China, we all love that movie. Tell us about what brought you into like that entertainment industry and what is your passion for it?
Well, you know, the passion started when I was very young. And then in the early 90s, I decided to expand myself to Asia. Starting in Hong Kong, I did a movie with Michelle Yeoh, you know, the Academy Award winner. We've been good friends for 30-something years.
We have 2 nominations, Best Drama Series, and I have a Best Supporting Actress nomination. It is a real-life drama series that centers on the stories of nurses, and it really shines a spotlight on what nurses go through on a day-to-day basis.
And the award for Best Screenplay goes to Dream of the Zelkova Tree.
The film was fun. 사진작가가 되고 싶었어.
Thank you so much to the LA Web Fest, also to the director who's done a fantastic job to nurture and support new explosive talent. I received this on behalf of our network, NTD TV, who could not be here. This is an NTD career production. about a sweet story about a mother and her daughter and a relationship between them. Fantastic. We are so proud and so thankful for this award. Thank you. The cast and crew are very, very grateful, and I thank you very much for this.
Congratulations to NTD Original, NTD Korea Production, for Dream of the Zelkova Tree. This is best screenplay for the whole of this amazing LA Web Fest.
This has been Ruby Lovell, NTD in Hollywood.
Okay, and next, some breaking news. We are tuning in to President Biden's live remarks on his Investing in America agenda in Racine, Wisconsin, which, of course, is a key battleground state. Let's tune in.
And a great set of labor organizations can forge the kind of partnership that will create the jobs and opportunity for the people, not just of today, but for the future. And then I just want to say, it starts at the local level. Mount Pleasant, what an extraordinary place. When I look at Dave DeGroot, the village president, when I see the county executive for Racine, for the mayor of Racine, Governor Evers, from his first meeting with me, to do the things that needed to be done to make this happen. But I want you to know something else, because I think it's especially fitting on a day like today. Everything that we are doing here in Racine County, Wisconsin, is also benefiting directly from the work of this White House and this president over the last 4 years. Every day you see the news of the day, but what really matters is the work over a number of years. And in 2021, this president sat down across the aisle and persuaded our Congress to pass a bipartisan infrastructure law, a bipartisan infrastructure law that is investing in the roads and bridges that are needed to bring the steel to this plant, that have injected more than $1 billion into a cause in which we've long believed, bringing broadband connectivity to everyone in the state of Wisconsin. That's a part of this. And then again in 2022, it took people coming together in Washington to pass the CHIPS and Science Act, because believe me, a data center without chips doesn't do very much for anybody. And again in 2022, because of the Inflation Reduction Act, it became possible to aim higher to achieve the climate and energy goals that also are indispensable to what we need to do as a company and all of us need to do as a community right here. And then last year in 2023, this White House, this administration, and this president really led the tech sector and the country and even the world to recognize how much AI was changing the world, but that we need to ensure that it's safe, that it's secure, that it's used responsibly. And they brought people together so we could move fast to do precisely that. And finally, every day since the first day of the inauguration in 2021, I just have to say, as someone who spends part of every single day working on and worrying about the cybersecurity protection of our customers in this nation, no administration has done as much as this administration to protect the cybersecurity of our communities and our country as a whole. It takes all kinds of people that find a way to get things done. And as I introduce the person who will introduce the president, the person who is doing the recruiting to bring in the people that will build the building, that will house the technology, that will serve the world, Nick Fick, who comes from the IBEW right here in Racine, let me leave you with one final thought. I hope that with everything else that's going on in the world today, people here in Wisconsin and people across the country will just take a moment to remember this. This day shows something important. It shows that America remains what it has always been. We are a country where people come together, where people work together, where they address hard challenges, and we get great things done. We won't let you down. Please welcome Nick Fett.
Great job. Oh, man. Thank you. Wow. That's going to be a tough act to follow there. It's good to see all you friendly faces in the crowd today. Good morning. My name is Nick Fick. I'm a proud 23-year member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 430 in Racine, Wisconsin. Thank you. I was born and raised here. But a few years after I completed my apprenticeship, the contractor I was working for had to explore all options due to lack of work in the area. I traveled the country for them, then came back home to start a family. In 2017, good news about local economic development was hard to come by. When plans were announced for a new high-tech manufacturing complex in Racine, it could not have come at a better time. Unfortunately, we all know what happened next. After all that hype and all that hope, the promises made by Donald Trump failed to come true in Racine County. But now our luck has changed. Microsoft plans to spend billions of dollars to build data centers on the same property Foxconn has abandoned. Now local 430 members are installing temporary power and lighting, along with the preliminary underground work needed. And this is just the start. They are calling this site Microsoft's crown jewel, the biggest footprint of any Microsoft facility in the world. That means long-term work for hundreds of skilled professional IBEW electricians for 10 to 15 years. Now, I have the good fortune to have the job here at home organizing electricians into the IBEW. Thank you. Thanks to Joe Biden, advanced manufacturing jobs are coming back to America and back to our hometown. We are grateful to Microsoft for investing in America and here in Mount Pleasant.
Biden yet to speak there, but for round-the-clock original news coverage, visit us at ntd.com or download our NTD app.
And be sure to stick around for NTD Newsroom at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll cover more stories from the U.S. and around the world.
A faith rich in beauty and tradition, uplifting the mind and body, persevering through decades of persecution. Watch our special coverage of the 2024 World Falun Dafa Day Parade live from New York City, starting 11 a.m. Eastern Time, here on NTD.